Today on the 21st Show, it's been years since avian influenza began causing trouble for farmers. It's affecting animals and the food we buy at the supermarket. Unless you work with farm animals, the risk to humans remains low, for now. But the Trump administration is making cuts to science and public health, which raises questions about the government's preparedness and competence should there be another significant disease outbreak. So today we're spending the full hour on the past, present, and future of bird flu, what it means for our food supply, and for our own health. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Over the past few years, the United States has been fighting a significant battle against avian influenza. It's affected all sorts of animals. Since the start of the year, just in Illinois, it's been found in chickens, hawks, geese, and even a seal and a flamingo in Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo. Avian flu has especially meant trouble for farmers. 17 states have reported outbreaks in dairy cows, though Illinois is not one of them. And in January, Cockadoodle Farms in Madison, in the south suburbs of Chicago, lost a flock of 3,000 hens to the bird flu. Owners Mary Kate and Marty Thomas talked about that experience with CBS Chicago.
These chickens were providing close to 2,000 dozen eggs a week for our marketplace, and with egg prices and feed costs, it's a huge loss.
When bad things happen to you, you can either ask, why me, or what's next? So we're asking, what's next?
Well, we're certainly seeing the effects at the supermarket. The average cost of a dozen eggs hit an all-time high, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture says those prices are likely to keep climbing this year. So today, for the entire show, we're going to be talking about avian flu. I should add up front, health officials say the risk to humans is low at present. But later in the hour, we'll talk about concerns around what avian flu could mean for people, especially under the Trump administration, where mass firings have created concerns about responding to potential outbreaks or even a pandemic. Worth noting, next week marks 5 years since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic. But we start with the bigger picture of what we are seeing and what this means for agriculture and the economy. Joining me throughout the hour today is Dr. Emily Landon. She's an associate professor of medicine and executive director of infection prevention and control at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. Dr. Landon, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Hey, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also with us for the first part of the hour is Tasha Bunting, director of commodity programs and food systems for the Illinois Farm Bureau. Tasha, welcome to the show to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Stephanie Lewis, clinical assistant professor in zoological medicine at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's also director of the Wildlife Medical Clinic at Illinois. Stephanie, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, you can join our conversation today throughout the hour by calling 800-222-9455. We'll also have text messages to share as we go on. What questions do you have about avian flu? How's the price of eggs looked over the past few visits to the supermarket? And how worried are you about bird flu or avian flu spreading to people? Maybe you're a farmer who's been affected by this. Let us know at 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. All right, Dr. Landon, I'm going to start with you. What makes bird flu different from other kinds of flu we talk about?
Well, something that people frequently don't understand about influenza is that there are a lot of different kinds of influenza. Every species can get their own kind of influenza. There are influenzas for cattle, influenzas for dogs, influenzas for cats, influenzas for pigs, and influenzas for birds. And this particular strain has been around for quite a long time, and it's called high pathogenicity avian influenza because it is really dangerous for birds. And that can sometimes pass into humans. Sometimes we see these influenzas jump from one species to another. We call those spillover events. And that is how we can start to see some shifting or changing in the virus in order to make it more hospitable for humans. And that's how we can start to see problems where humans don't really have a lot of antibodies or immunity to viruses that mostly affect birds for obvious reasons. And that's how we can see pandemic potential in this sort of event.
Professor Stephanie Lewis, what makes this particular strain of avian flu we've been dealing with these past few years different from earlier outbreaks, especially when it comes to how it spreads around animals?
Yeah, so, we had another outbreak of high pathogenic avian influenza back in 2014, 2015, and that one primarily circulated in our waterfowl species, and of course it affected poultry, including domestic poultry. And then it kind of fizzled out, towards summer and at the end of the year. What's making this particular strain unique is the huge variety of species, at least in wildlife, and we're seeing the same effect in domestics as well. The huge variety of species that we're seeing it affect, where the high pathogenic and low pathogenic strain typically circulates primarily in waterfowl. But what we were seeing with this strain is that we're seeing it a lot in our raptor species. Hawks, eagles, owls, scavenging species like vultures and crows. And then we started seeing it in our mammal species as well, which had definitely not been seen in that previous outbreak. So we're seeing it in primarily carnivores, so like bobcats, we're seeing it in omnivores and scavengers like raccoons and opossums, and even in marine mammals like seals and dolphins. And so it's spreading, it seems to be spreading very quickly and easily through a variety of species. And then we're seeing other spillovers in our domestic animals as well. And then it kind of is staying put. I'm a wildlife veterinarian, and we've been dealing with this since, early 2022, and it's kind of not going away. It doesn't look like it's going to go away anytime soon.
How is it spreading? How does the infection actually move from bird to bird? Yeah. Are the birds coughing on each other? Is it pooping in the chicken feed? What is it?
It's primarily fecal-oral, but it can be all of the above. They shed, especially the waterfowl, shed a large amount of virus in the feces. And then, ducks and geese, they're living and eating in the same water that they're defecating in. And they're, especially this time of year and during migration season, they're congregating in really large flocks. And so there's really close contact. There's close contact with one another's feces. And then it can also be shed in respiratory secretions and respiratory droplets. And so it can be shed that way. We also have a lot of spread from ingesting an animal that has died of the disease. So that's what we're seeing a lot in our raptor and scavenging species, that if a duck has died of avian influenza and then an eagle comes and predates on, and ingests that animal, and then they can succumb to the disease as well.
All right, Tasha, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Tasha Bunting from the Illinois Farm Bureau. What have you seen in terms of the spread of avian flu on Illinois farms?
Well, fortunately, we have not seen a widespread issue here in the state of Illinois. We have had a couple of commercial producers, as well as the farm that you mentioned earlier in the hour about having an issue earlier this year. So we are seeing and hearing from our poultry producers that they are trying to work on improving biosecurity methods, definitely trying to separate wildlife and wild birds from their flocks so that they don't have that cross-contamination of feed and water, and trying to make other improvements so that they can help protect their flock.
Dr. Landon, let me come back to you. Let's talk a little more about this idea of spillover, which you mentioned, where a virus spreads from animals to humans. People might remember that you can characterize that, the leading hypothesis for how COVID-19 became a human pandemic. What can you tell us? How do we see this avian influenza spreading from animals to humans so far?
Well, influenza and many other respiratory viruses can spread between species. And in fact, that's how a lot of the diseases that we have in humans, Ebola and other hemorrhagic fever viruses or zoonoses or viruses that come from animals and then can actually also affect humans. And that's what we're seeing here with this avian influenza. It's not uncommon. There have been other there's been pig origin influenzas or swine influenzas in the past. So influenza is a virus that has like sort of eight pieces of genetic material in it, and it's known for changing every single year. This is part of the reason why you need a new flu shot every year, because it undergoes every time it replicates, there are tiny mistakes that are made, and that can change the way the outside of the virus is, that which changes the way our body recognizes it. And so we need an update to our immunity. And when we have different kinds of viruses, like the ones in cattle or in pigs or in birds or in dogs and humans coming together in say the same animal sometimes, that can result in really big shifts to how the virus can function. But we can also just see small changes in the virus over time that make it more hospitable for human. And as humans have contact with these animals, the viruses that have the errors that make them a little bit more hospitable to humans, then those viruses can take root in us humans, and then we can maybe, and eventually possibly be able to spread them on. I want to be clear, at the present time, there's no evidence of human-to-human transmission of this HPAI or H5N1 or bird flu or avian flu or whatever you want to call it. Right now, people can get infections from having close contact with the animals that are affected, but they cannot spread it from person to person. That is another shift or a change that would have to happen in the virus in order for it to become a pandemic.
Tasha, what happens when a farm finds its chickens dealing with bird flu?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, our farmers are working very closely with their herd veterinarian or their flock veterinarian to ensure that the proper testing is taking place and they quickly identify what issue they're dealing with. So once they make contact with their herd veterinarian and submit samples to the laboratories for confirmation of the disease, then they work with the state veterinarians and USDA APHIS officials to determine what the pr proper procedure and protocols will be at that time if it is in fact avian influenza. So once a herd has been identified as having a positive case, unfortunately, it is 100% fatal. And so the quickest way to stop the spread is to eradicate the herd and depopulate the herd or the flock as quickly as possible. So they work with those animal health officials in order to depopulate their flock and start towards virus disinfection and containing what they can within their farm.
And Professor Lewis, let me ask you, or actually, Tasha, I have another follow-up question to that. Actually, one of the things that I thought was really interesting that I learned in preparing for this segment is that there's actually a financial incentive, I understand, for farms to report chickens that are sick or dead with the avian flu. Can you speak to that?
I wouldn't say that it's necessarily an incentive, but there is an opportunity for them to recoup some of their costs in the event that they would have to depopulate. So they would be able to have some funding through various programs to help. It won't make them whole. It won't offset
Sure.
the loss of market that they would receive, but it will help cover the costs and the expense of disinfecting and depopulating, and then they can also receive a payment for the birds that are actually depopulated at that time.
Yeah, my understanding, and maybe I'm off base on this, but is that the incentive came into the idea that the longer you waited, the less money you would get. The earlier you report it, it actually, so it incentivizes farmers to say, raise their hand early and say, look, I think I have a problem here, instead of trying to wait it out and hope it kind of gets better or goes away on its own. But I don't know if you can speak to that aspect of it.
Well, so if they just sort of wait it out and all of the animals, the bird, like I mentioned earlier, it is fatal in poultry. So if they don't do anything and they don't report it, then there is no opportunity to have any of those payments received.
Okay. Professor Lewis, Let's return to the wild birds, which is where we're, as you mentioned, we're seeing this spreading. How easy or difficult is it to get a sense of how widespread this is among wild birds?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it can be tricky because, you know, it's just not feasible to test every single wild bird or even every single wild bird that has died. You know, just financially, you know, our wildlife rehabilitation centers and the Illinois Department of Natural Resources just would not be able to test every bird. So I think the numbers that are being reported are probably very underreported. And I don't think we have a full understanding of, you know, the scope of what we're seeing, because, you know, a lot of animals we're not going to find, you know, if they pass away somewhere that is not a populated area, as far as human activity is concerned, we're not going to find those animals. And so I think it's hard to really get your full head around the entire scope of what's happening.
Yeah. All right. We need to take a break on the program. We are talking for the whole hour today about avian flu, how it's affecting animals and by extension farming and the cost of our groceries. Later in the hour, we'll get into how it's affected people so far and how prepared we are for any future developments with that. I want to read a few text messages we got. Franny and Hinkley said, "Fortunately, I can afford to buy the eggs that I enjoy for breakfast and the eggs that I need for the cookies I bake. However, I am very concerned about the effect of the bird flu on populations of our wild and farm birds. Wild bird populations have been declining for years. I wish we could find a cure for this." We also heard from Edward in Champaign, who said avian flu is such an existential threat and has had such a great impact on the economy and on farmers' livelihoods. You would think the president would be talking about it and working on it all the time, but he's too busy renaming the Gulf of Mexico, paving the Rose Garden, and declaring English the official language of the country. What excellent priorities. A little political there, Edward. Thank you for that message. We are talking again about avian flu. My guests are Tasha Bunting with the Illinois Farm Bureau, Stephanie Lewis, director of the Wildlife Medical Clinic at U of I Urbana-Champaign, and Emily Landon with the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. You can join us. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. We'll get to some calls when we return. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking for the hour about avian influenza, how it's affecting animals and farming and the cost of our groceries. A little later in the hour, we'll talk about how it's affecting people so far and how prepared we are for any future outbreaks that may come with this disease. My guests for the first part of the show today, at least, are Dr. Emily Landon with the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine, Tasha Bunting with the Illinois Farm Bureau, and Dr. Stephanie Lewis, director of the Wildlife Medical Clinic at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And if you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455. And let's go now to the phones, where Mike is calling from Springfield. Mike, thank you for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call. I was reading in the newspaper today that the French have a vaccine for avian influenza, but that we don't use it in America due to trade considerations. I wonder if your guest could speak to, was the newspaper right? Does there such a vaccine exist, and what are the trade implications? Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that call, Mike. Dr. Lewis, I wonder if you can speak to that. Is there a vaccine for this that we are not using because of some trade rules?
Yeah, I can. So that is correct. So the concern is that if we vaccinate our poultry, that they could not show evidence that they are infected with highly pathogenic avian influenza, and they can test positive, you know, so it can be difficult to differentiate whether or not the animal is just vaccinated or actually positive with the disease. And so, you know, I don't work that much with poultry, but I, from what I've heard, it, the, you know, it is difficult to to export those animals and animal products. We have used the vaccine in a small subset of wild birds, but I should note that the vaccine that was used was actually for a different strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza, not the exact one that we are seeing currently. But the USDA did give special permission to vaccinate California condors. Because obviously they are definitely an endangered species, a species of significant concern, and the population is very closely monitored. And so they were able to actually catch up those birds and vaccinate them and even give them a booster for the vaccine and then re-release them back into the wild. That, of course, is not necessarily feasible for all of our wild birds and most of our wild populations, but the vaccine is pretty closely controlled by the USDA. I think I heard that there is another vaccine that is under development. I think from Zoetis, but we don't know a whole lot yet about that one.
Let's take another call from Bill in Decatur on line three. Bill, thank you for calling in.
Hi there. Good morning. Thank you. I was chatting with my daughter the other day, and the subject of bird flu come up. And she told me that it had become endemic amongst the dairy cattle herds. Is that in fact true?
All right. Thank you, Bill, for that. Dr. Lewis, I don't know if you can take that, or Tasha Bunting with the Illinois Farm Bureau, maybe?
It is circulating among dairy cattle. It can be subclinical. My understanding is that it can be subclinical in dairy cattle, so they can have the disease and shed it and then not appear sick, though some of them can have, you know, clinical signs. It's definitely not in all dairy cattle, but it has been documented in dairy cattle. That's correct.
Maybe we should explain, what does endemic mean as opposed to pandemic or some of the other terms that we're using here? You also mentioned subclinical.
Sorry. Yeah. So endemic means that it's a kind of a normal natural reservoir of the disease. You know, it's something that they circulate frequently, don't always show clinical signs. And so subclinical means that they have the illness, but they're not sick with the illness or due to the illness.
And Tasha Bunting, I don't know if you want to speak to how the Farm Bureau is thinking about dairy cattle in this context.
Sure, I appreciate that. So fortunately, here in Illinois, we have not had any dairy farms test positive for high-path avian influenza. It is circulating primarily out west in California right now. It started in Texas and has sort of spread throughout several different herds that have had connection in one way or another, whether that's animals moving back and forth or farm workers. So it is something that the dairy industry is very closely monitoring. In fact, in Illinois, we have started testing all of the milk silos at our milk processors for the presence of HPAI. That surveillance just started the middle of last week through the Illinois Department of Public Health. And so as more information is learned and the animal health experts, as well as the public health experts, are able to identify sort of the transmission and the movement of the virus and where it's occurring, we can help better protect not only our dairy farms, but also farm workers and all individuals that are coming into contact with those herds as well. A little bit different in the dairy side compared to poultry, it is not fatal to those dairy cows that might be infected, but it does drop their milk production. And so it might not be as recognized as early on due to a lot of different fluctuations on how milk is produced and how dairy farms and cows and their production levels change throughout the year.
All right. At this point, I need to, Dr. Lewis, I know you need to leave, so I'll just say Dr. Stephanie Lewis is director of the Wildlife Medical Clinic at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you for being with us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me. Super interesting conversation.
Thank you. And we are going to continue on for a little while with Tasha Bunting of the Illinois Farm Bureau and Dr. Emily Landon, Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. Tasha, the price of eggs has come up a lot in this conversation. It's been a big part of American politics, at least rhetorically, in the past few years. We got a message from Laura in Peoria Heights who said the price of eggs definitely has skyrocketed and definitely impacted my budget. There are only so many substitutions you can make use of. It doesn't make sense. The eggs have increased so much in price, but actual chicken meat hasn't. I'm not one to jump on every conspiracy, but this seems odd to me. Thank you for that message, Laura. Tasha, can you speak to that? Why egg prices? What goes into to setting the price of eggs and why that might be different from chicken meat?
Sure. So we are seeing the outbreak occurring primarily in our laying facilities. So where we are having birds that are raised to lay eggs, not the broilers that are raised for meat. I think maybe one of the disease experts might be able to speak to why that is occurring or might have some thoughts on why it's happening in our layer facilities versus our broiler facilities. But the price of eggs, I agree, has definitely skyrocketed here recently. And I think it goes back to a lot of supply and demand, basic economics in most areas due to the disease happening in those laying facilities. And just the reduction in the number of eggs that are available is certainly impacting how we are seeing those egg prices rise.
And I guess while we're, as we kind of wrap up the sort of animal-focused portion of our show, Dr. Landon, let me ask you, what can people do to protect themselves and their pets from avian flu? I know I have a friend who walks his dog through a park, and he his dog came across a bird carcass, was really curious about it. Obviously, that seems like a red flag. What are you telling people to think about in this context?
This is a great question. And I also have a dog who's interested in all sorts of things I don't want him to be interested in on walks. So the most important thing to remember when it comes to ourselves is contact with sick or at-risk wildlife or agricultural livestock, right? And so if you are but usually you know if you're one of these people. So if you are the kind of person or a person who routinely has contact with cattle or pigs or poultry on farms, then you should know whether or not your farm where you're working is participating in a testing program, what the risk is, and you should be taking the appropriate precautions. There's a lot of information on the CDC's website about that and on our local health department website, or you can just call the health department and ask. That's a great thing. They are wonderful resources to help you with that. If you are a regular person, not that people who deal with wildlife or with agricultural livestock or not, but if you are not someone who deals with that, then you need to be careful about wild birds and then about what you consume that comes from livestock. So when it comes to wild birds, if you see a dead bird in the wild right now, you need to leave it be. Many communities like Chicago have programs where you can call someone to come and remove this safely. If you need to know how to remove these birds from your own property safely, then I recommend you call your local animal control or your local health department, and they should give you advice on how to safely dispose of those animals. When it comes to your animals being around these other dead or damaged wild birds, you really do not want your dogs and cats to be anywhere near these animals. And so if you are routinely letting your dogs around or cats out outside, a lot of people are considering transitioning outside cats to inside cats temporarily while we deal with this situation. Certainly letting dogs run off lead over large swaths of property is going to be a little bit risky. And so you'll have to think about how you're going to handle that and how you might be able to reduce the risk for those animals. And again, you know, we really don't want our animals eating goose poop or sniffing around dead animals. And so you're going to have to be extra careful because we do know that animals can and do die. They can get avian influenza and they can become very, very ill. There were some cases in cats, in fact. When it comes to you personally, don't touch dead animals. That's great advice in general. And then I think it's really, really important that we talk about pasteurized milk and pasteurized dairy products at this point. Pasteurization kills H5N1, avian flu, HPAI in dairy products. If you are drinking unpasteurized milk or eating unpasteurized dairy products, your risk is much, much, much higher. This is not the time to be drinking unpasteurized milk. I understand that many people think that there's a good microbiome and benefit from that for your immune system, and I'm going to leave that to the side. I think that many, many people have died from unpasteurized milk. That's not the way I would choose to enrich my microbiome. But even if you feel like that is okay at some times, now is not the time to do that.
All right, good advice there. We're going to change up our panel for the rest of the program today. So at this point, I am going to thank Tasha Bunting from the Illinois Farm Bureau. Thank you for being with us. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And let me just remind listeners more broadly, this is the 21st show. Well, through the program today, we're talking about the state of avian flu in Illinois and beyond. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to take a deeper dive into what we're seeing in public health. There have been 70 reported cases across the country of bird flu in humans, one death. I'll say again, health officials indicate the risk to humans is low right now. There's no recorded human-to-human spread of avian influenza, but there are still fears of a potential pandemic. One extra concern is that the federal government, under President Donald Trump and Elon Musk, has put limits on the ability of agencies to communicate with health experts and the public. And there's also ongoing mass layoffs and policy changes in government, which raise even more concerns about how the government could respond to disease outbreaks. We've been talking about the bigger health picture with Dr. Emily Landon, Associate Professor of Medicine and Executive Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. And I want to bring in another voice now. Amy Maxman is public health local editor and correspondent with KFF Health News. She's been covering the bird flu over the past year. Amy, thank you so much for making the time to be with us today on the 21st show.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
I want to dive right in with you, Amy. What sort of work have government agencies traditionally done when it comes to diseases like this?
Yeah, so basically, when you have an outbreak, especially if it's an outbreak of an emerging disease, and this is emerging in terms of we haven't seen it in this many animals before, sort of bird flu is changing from what it was 20 years ago. So when you have an outbreak of a disease that you're worried about, whether that's measles or Ebola or HIV or COVID or now the bird flu, what you tend to want to do is make sure you're keeping track of it so you know who's infected, who they might infect. And that when I say they, I guess any sort of living being might infect. And then you want to prevent that spread from happening. And so kind of it's a matter of, it's like containing a wildfire. You basically want to detect the virus, predict where it's going to go next, and stop it from spreading there.
And Dr. Landon, from your standpoint, how have you seen that work or not work with the government in the past?
Oh, yeah. Amy has it 100% right. That's what the best, most granular epidemiologic picture that we can get of what's happening in animals is going to be the best way for us to understand how to protect and prevent that from spreading to humans. We know influenza so much better than we know coronavirus. And so we know the steps that an influenza virus takes in terms of the genetic mutations that it needs in order to become transmissible in humans, to go from being a bird virus to being a predominantly human virus. And so the more granular information we can get, exactly which cattle are infected, exactly which bird flocks are infected, exactly what the sequence of those viruses are and what they look like, we can trace exactly what is spilling over to where. We can see that there are some cat, there was a case of, to give an example, there was a case of a sick teenager in British Columbia with a specific strain of HPAI, H5N1, that we then found in wild birds, which we then found in some Nevada dairy herds, which shows us exactly how things are transmitting and where things are, when they're there, and exactly how they're likely to develop the newest mutations and result in more significant risk and threat to the humans. Now, how is that working? It worked great with that particular issue with the Nevada herds. However, I think that our picture of how the epidemiologic picture of HPAI is not as clear as it could be. And it's not likely to get clearer with significant cuts to public health funding and with not very strict rules about who has to submit samples and which farms have to be tested and what has to be done in order to take care of these animals. No, make no mistake, if we want to avoid having those steps of genetic mutation happen to where we're facing another pandemic, and I don't know how significant it would be or how dangerous it would be to humans, but if we want to avoid having that happen, the best way to do that is to get it taken care of now and to contain it, as Amy said, in animals by understanding the picture. And that requires a lot of effort, a lot of investment, and a lot of time. That's not a waste. That's not a government waste. That's literally protecting your health.
And we'll talk about whether that investment and time and capacity is still there in our federal government after we take a short break. Again, 800-222-9455. If you want to join us, this is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the state of avian flu in Illinois and beyond, focusing for the last part of the show today on public health. Again, there have been 70 reported cases across the country of bird flu in humans, one death, but officials are saying the risk to humans right now, at least, is low, although there is concern about what the government has been doing in terms of cutbacks and putting a block on communicating with other health experts and the public. My guests for the last part of the show today are Dr. Emily Landon, Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine, and Amy Maxman, Public Health Local Editor and Correspondent with KFF Health News. She's been covering this topic for the past year. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. And let's go now to the phones again. Theodore is calling from Urbana on line 2. Theodore, thank you for waiting.
Hi. I had a question. So my understanding is that there's a routine every year. There's a committee which meets maybe around this time of year to decide what are the most likely human influenza strains we need to worry about next fall and flu season in order to guide the vaccine manufacturers. And I read a rumor just recently in the last couple of days, a random anonymous federal employee saying this committee is not meeting or isn't going to meet or nobody knows what's going on. And I'm just wondering if your guests have any information as to whether that's true or not.
All right. Thank you for that question, Theodore. Amy Maxman, can you speak to this idea of the group that just sort of sets the course for the flu vaccine next year?
Yeah, it's a group of advisors on immunization practices, and they were supposed to meet in late February, and that meeting was kind of suddenly just postponed. They didn't get any word on when it would be resumed. And now, of course, there's fears that that committee will be disbanded. But that, as far as I know, has not happened yet. But the meeting was just suddenly postponed. And that was a meeting where they would discuss this. There's other things like the CDC traditionally sends data on the sequence of the circulating seasonal flu vaccines to the World Health Organization's international platforms, where researchers can look at a lot of different sequences of what flu strains are circulating and use that to inform vaccines. So apparently the CDC hasn't been sharing that information on these international platforms. Right now, it's so hard to know, you know, what are just delays, which would themselves be nerve-wracking, or if it's going to go even further. So it's hard to know there. And just to add, since we're also talking about bird flu, this is all about the seasonal flu, not the bird flu.
So the bird flu wouldn't have been sort of incorporated into the seasonal flu. There was no thought of that in the normal course of things. Yeah. Maybe you, Amy, you can speak more broadly to what we know so far about how the Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control have been affected by President Trump and Elon Musk's so-called DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency, in terms of their personnel and practices and everything else that's been happening so far.
Well, we know we've seen layoffs in the workplace. There's been data that was taken down. There was from the CDC website, for example, like data from youth behavioral surveys. People had a hard time finding HIV data. I noticed while doing a story on the measles that some of the information on measles that, you know, school principals could use to talk to parents when there's an outbreak at their school, I couldn't find that on the CDC's website. There was a lawsuit filed and a judge ordered the agencies to restore the data that had been taken down, and that happened. At least some of it was restored with this sort of statement at the top showing that the Trump administration was not in favor of data that might have words that they didn't like in it, like transgender. So some was restored. Some stuff has just been moved around. At the moment, it's just sort of a lot of confusion. I've covered several studies that were expected to be out in regular publications from the CDC, the Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report, something the CDC's put out for, you know, many decades now, and that's completely scientific report. It sort of looks at data based on, you know, sort of that gives us a picture of health in the country, and then it might make some recommendations for the public or for doctors or hospitals based on the current situation on, you know, any number of health conditions that could be anything from, you know, suicides to the bird flu. There had been some studies on the bird flu I knew about that were slated for publication, say, in January 23rd, and those were delayed for a number of weeks. So I think the questions now are, you know, that was disconcerting, again, because it hasn't happened before. These aren't things that have political oversight, so it's not normal that you would have an administration change and that the scientific studies would be backed up. So that was worrying, and I think there's concerns this might happen in the future, and there's hopes that it won't.
Dr. Landon, from your perspective, I think we've talked about this on the program in the past, but, you know, we have somebody who is avowedly anti-vax or vaccine skeptical. I guess he technically denies it, but I mean, you can talk about what happened in American Samoa. We don't have to go into down that rabbit hole, but in the form of RFK Jr., talk about where you are, how you think about what that means for the competence and the, you know, ability of the federal government to do what it has done in the past, or at least tried to do in the past, with regard to disease outbreaks.
Well, we are definitely seeing a clear indication from the new administration that things that we consider to be essential parts of public health or essential parts of research or essential parts of sort of things that prevent threats and help people avoid disease as being not a priority anymore. And that is not necessarily something that I think the American people are in agreement on. And I think it's very concerning. I think RFK Jr.'s position on vaccines is fringe. You know, the vast majority of Americans believe in and use and take vaccines that are really important for protecting children and adults, especially through things like herd immunity, so that those of us who get older and have other medical problems or are immunocompromised or are protected from ongoing outbreaks of these deadly diseases because so many other people are vaccinated. And it's very difficult to reconcile RFK Jr.'s positions on this over time and what his actual intentions are going to be. So far, we've seen massive, you know, an attempt to make massive cuts in the federal expenditure on research, which seems like it might not be the most important thing to pay for when eggs are so expensive at the store, but it is that kind of research that helps protect the bird so that the egg prices don't go up. So this is why we need that sort of thing. The United States has been the sort of best in the world in terms of that kind of research and this kind of public health funding, and cutting it back indiscriminately, you know, with a hacksaw or a chainsaw is probably not what I'd like to see. I think we need to be a lot more careful, a lot more granular if we're gonna think about where we might make cuts for efficiency's sake. And it is gonna have an effect on our public health.
I mean, Maxman, what is your understanding of, like, I mean, I've seen conflicting reports about whether the Epidemic Intelligence Service, for example, there was one report I saw where 1,200 people were going to be laid off, and then it was, okay, that wasn't going to happen after all. Can you speak to the specific capacity of the CDC right now to be able to respond to these things? Or is it, again, this is part of that open question you were talking about a few minutes ago?
Yeah, I can't tell you the latest assessment of their capacities right now.
Okay, that's fair. Let's go back to the phones. Bill is calling from Springfield on line 3. Bill, thank you for calling in.
You're welcome. I'm wondering if you think it's possible that the science of genetics could be able to engineer an avian flu which would greatly reduce the chances of avian flu spreading to humans.
You mean like a vaccine for it, or actually modifying the virus that's spreading now among birds somehow?
Good question. I mean actually modifying the virus, the structure, the genetic structure of the virus itself. So it will become a mutation that is not particularly likely to spread to human beings.
Huh. We don't have any virologists on the panel. Dr. Landon, I don't know if you can speak to that at all.
Yeah. That is what a vaccine is. So that's exactly what a vaccine is. We take the virus and we try and make it less dangerous. We attenuate it. And then you give that's a live virus vaccine. We can also kill it, you know, whatever we need to do. And then you can give that to animals to help protect them so that they have an immune response to any version of H5N1 that comes around. And then they won't spread it so much. And then it won't be spread to humans. But it is really hard to vaccinate wild birds. And it is really expensive to vaccinate poultry and cattle, and really hard, especially with such anti-vaccine sentiment. It's also going to be difficult to vaccinate humans. We saw what happened with COVID. So it's a great idea, but it is an idea that we've been fighting for many, many years. And I really hope that that all of our listeners are on side and engaged in that process and excited about the opportunity to do that. And those projects are underway.
Yeah, you mentioned the sort of fatigue among humans and difficulty in vaccinating people. There's a sad story out of Texas, a measles outbreak there. But one of the, I guess, rays of light coming out of that is that people are returning to vaccines, at least as the reporting I've seen. Dr. Landon, talk about that a little more, though, this idea of pandemic fatigue. It's still there for a lot of people. It was just 5 years ago, feels like a lifetime ago, when we were just beginning to get into the you know, understanding how serious COVID-19 was going to be, the lockdowns or stay-at-home orders started happening in March of 2020. How do you navigate that as you're trying to keep people in the loop and as you said, on side with what's happening with the bird flu?
Well, I think it's really challenging. I think that having a lot of voices from the current administration shouting about just really sort of hyperbole type statements instead of talking about real science and real issues is not great. I think we have to stick to what is actually happening, being honest about what the threat is, being honest about what we're asking people to do, being honest about why we're asking people to do it, and magnifying and amplifying messaging that is, you know, about having trackers in vaccines or dangerous things that just aren't true is not great for the American public. And it's not great for our pandemic preparedness. It really gives people more fatigue to be getting lots and lots of different, you know, being told, oh, it's totally safe. Oh, it's not safe at all. It's going to kill you. Like, it's really hard to make a decision between those two when you don't have a degree in medicine, right? And so it can be really challenging for people to navigate that. And they need to know who to trust. And in my experience, and I am, you know, part of the medical, you know, world, but are the physicians that take care of you every day and the public health people that work in our local public health offices are absolutely there to make things as easy and as safe and as healthy for people in America as they possibly can. No one is out to get anyone. No one's trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. We're all trying to help people do as best they can in their lives. And so I would say, trust your doctor, trust your local public health officials, and encourage the government to keep funding those local public health officials. You know, about 80%, more than 80% of my local public health officials in the city of Chicago are funded by federal dollars. And if we lose those positions, then we lose people to do the things that we really need them to do to help doctors make the best choices that we can when we're counseling you in the exam room about what's the right thing for you and your family.
Mm-hmm. Amy Maxman, just with KFF Health News, just about a minute left. What are you going to be watching for in the weeks and months ahead?
I'll be watching the bird flu and public health. Thanks.
All right. Amy Maxman is public health local editor and correspondent with KFF Health News, has been covering the bird flu for the past year. Dr. Emily Landon, associate professor of medicine and executive director of infection prevention and control at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. Thank you both for being with us today on the 21st show. And that is all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow, we are going to be talking about Medicaid, the federal government, the Republican budget blueprint that Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives passed last week. It's looking to cut well more than $800 billion from the federal budget. The only way to do that is to really go after either Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. And most observers think Medicaid is the most likely. That's the program of health care for the poor and disabled. What would that mean for Illinois, where one in four people get their health coverage through the Medicaid program? We're going to be talking about that. Plus, it is tax season. I got mine filed this weekend. Hopefully you are on top of things. But if you haven't yet, what are the things you should know heading into it? There's actually some sort of protest tax movement springing up too. We'll talk more about that as well. That's all coming up tomorrow on The 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. You can get a podcast of this show wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, or even on YouTube. You can find that by searching for Illinois Public Media. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.